Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today we're going to take on the issue of why wokeness? Who does it serve? My guest on Skype from the United Kingdom is Brendan O'Neill. Brendan is a British columnist and the editor of Spiked Online, an internet magazine that focuses on politics and culture and society. He's a columnist for The Australian and London's The Big Issue, the latter being a socially conscious street newspaper printed in four continents and serving as a source of income for the homeless. Brendan has also contributed to The Spectator, BBC News, The Christian Science Monitor, Salon, and occasionally blog for The Guardian and The Daily Telegraph. Earlier, he was a writer for the British magazine Living Marxism. He is the host of The Brendan O'Neill Show, a podcast aired on Spike's website, spike-online.com, that investigates the left-right divide, failures of globalization, and more recently, the cancel woke culture and the coronavirus pandemic. Nice to have you with us today, Brendan.
Hi, Gary.
I would like to begin by having you give us the overview about the letter published in Harper's Magazine and signed by academicians, scholars, and authors, singling out the frenzy in the younger generations who are leading the current demonstrations to silence free speech and even free thought. And no one, myself included, because I've led probably 500 demonstrations, but we're peaceful. We're bringing our message on whatever the issue is, and it goes back, in my case, over 53 years of being in the trenches of consumer activism. But we never engaged in any form of destruction to people or property, but rather tried to deconstruct the illegitimacy of the institutional view, like the big government view. And this particular audience that you'll be speaking with is coming from all different backgrounds. They're independent, conservative, liberal, atheist, agnostic, rabbis. We have them all listening. And partly is because I don't try to shove any ideology or politic down anyone's throat. I believe in the intelligence of the average listener and let them make up their own mind. Mine is wanting freedom of choice. So therefore, in the current society, if my freedom of choice is let us change what is wrong, but let's be inclusive in allowing all ideas on the table and then select those that are most likely to succeed. And suddenly people say, no, you don't have that right. We have that right. So then I ask, why don't I have that right? Why don't others have that right? Well, because you're on the wrong side of the issue. Well, what makes me wrong? Well, you're a Caucasian male, and we've just gone through 20 years of bashing, you know, hypermasculinity as if all men were hypermasculine and dominant. And now we're bashing the fact that we're Caucasian based upon Beverly Angelo's moronic book, White Fragility, without looking at the consequences if people took it seriously. And it's now being taught in American schools. But at the end of the day, there's only now a select group of people who are allowed or encouraged to be offended by anything or to make statements about anything. Would you put this in the context of how you see it? The form is yours. Take your time.
Yes, I agree with a great deal of that. And I think it's an incredibly worrying political climate. It's a very worrying political culture. I think it is. There's an extreme intolerance among some young activists, people who would call themselves left activists or social justice activists or woke activists, even though woke has now become a bit of an insult. I think among that section of society, there is a creeping intolerance. Sometimes it's even a violent intolerance. They will shout people down, shut down meetings, prevent people from speaking, and try to cancel them. And I think that's what the Harper's letter was getting at, this new cancel culture in which people can be swept aside or cast out in a very religious way because they don't hold the orthodox view. And I think it's very worrying, and it's something that people who consider themselves progressive, or indeed people who consider themselves conservative, whichever side of that spectrum you come from, I think it's something people should be worried about. It feels increasingly religious to me. I'm not using religious as an insult. I grew up in a religious family. I know huge numbers of religious people, and religion, I think, can do a lot of good in the world. but it feels religious in the sense of being almost cult-like. So, you know, I think there's a lot of cult-like behavior over the past few months in relation to the Black Lives Matter movement, where we've seen white people, usually upper middle class, well-educated white people, on their knees, begging for forgiveness, you know, taking part in these public displays of self-flagellation, beating themselves up over their white privilege or their white skin or whatever else it might be, you know, treating whiteness almost as a form of original sin that you must atone for forever, and judging people increasingly according to the color of their skin and whether they are good or evil, whether they adhere to every single correct woke way of thinking, in which case they are good and acceptable and they may speak in public, or whether they criticize any of those woke ways of thinking, in which case they are sinners, they are evil, they must be cast out of the temple or at least the university campus, they must be prevented from speaking, their words are akin to blasphemy, they are hurtful, they pollute men's souls, you know, all those kind of old-fashioned ideas have come back with a vengeance, but they're now dressed up in politically correct language. And my view is very straightforward. I consider myself as coming from the left. I have many, many friends on the right who I have a huge amount of respect for, but I happen to come from the left. And I always thought that left-wing politics at root was about expanding human choice, expanding human wealth, and expanding human freedom. It was about making life as comfortable for the ordinary working person as it already is for the person who is incredibly wealthy. Somewhere along the line, the left has lost its way. And instead of those things, it has become very censorious, very unforgiving, very shrill, and very judgmental. And that left movement is one I don't recognize and which I'm quite concerned about.
Thank you. I appreciate that opening statement. When we take a look at what is happening in the streets, part of my concern that tells me that there is a larger power behind this that we have yet to fully identify, but certainly major corporations are benefiting from it, and the body politic of the Democratic Party is certainly going to be swept into office, probably based upon having Black Lives Matter as their support and the illegal aliens as their support. But it's the media not covering stories honestly. They've already taken a position. So when you see demonstrations that are peaceful, good. But then when you see rioting and destruction of what amounts to thousands of small businesses, many of those businesses owned by minorities, but not a word, not a single interview have I seen of a small business person whose barber shop or boutique or bakery, whatever it is, restaurant, was demolished with no insurance. And as if that didn't happen. In fact, one of the most powerful people in American Congress, a man named Jerry Adler, said when confronted about this, oh, it's a myth that these riots occur. I don't think people would mind at all. In fact, we're a country that actually has monikered ourselves with the freedom of speech, even if we don't like what someone's saying. But now the media is only taking one side. They're not looking at the truth behind other conditions. What do you make of that, and who could be behind that being benefited from it?
I think that's a really important point. And there's an Orwellian dishonesty to some of the media coverage we've seen over the past few weeks and months in particular, in the sense that they're in a state of denial about things that we can all see with our own eyes. And they are giving us not even half the story. They're not telling the substance of the story in many cases. So they have ignored rioting. They have ignored the destruction, the utter destruction of small businesses and small shops, which, as you say, are very often minority owned. They've ignored the destruction of parts of cities in which there are large numbers of minority groups or working class people. And it's a great shame, or it is to their great shame, that they have done this. And I think, you know, there's also an Orwellian way in which these things are talked about. So very often on the BBC here in the UK, for example, we will often see the phrase peaceful protest about a protest which everyone knows was not peaceful, in which there were running clashes with the police, in which police were injured, in which people threw things at the police. Now, someone could legitimately stand up and make the case for heated, passionate protest. You know, Martin Luther King said that the riot is the voice of the unheard, or the cry of the unheard. Now, I'm perfectly happy for people to make that argument in certain situations, and we can agree with them or disagree with them. But the difference here is that there was just myth-making about the whole process, and we were just simply not told the truth about what was going on. And I found that incredibly striking for the reasons that you have touched upon, because one of the things that has struck me most about particularly the Black Lives Matter moment of the past few months, but also about woke politics more broadly, is the extent to which certain sections of the political establishment feel incredibly comfortable with this supposedly radical politics. The educational elites feel comfortable with it, the media class feels comfortable with it, and corporations, some of the most powerful capitalist entities in the world, feel very comfortable indeed with this kind of politics. You know, every Western corporation pretty much put out a statement about Black Lives Matter or a statement denouncing white supremacy. And as you say, lots of corporations are now buying up copies of Robin DiAngelo's horrendous book, White Fragility. I had the pleasure, shall we say, the dubious pleasure of having a TV discussion with Robin DiAngelo here in the United Kingdom last year. And I criticized her book and I criticized some of the arguments. And I said, I don't think it's helpful to racialize every single facet of life. And I don't think it's helpful to depict white people as this uniform blob who are all racist or who all have problematic beliefs drilled into them by society. And she looked really shocked because it struck me that no one had said that to her before. No one had said, what are you talking about? Why are you writing this book? Thankfully, now many more people are saying it and there is a bit of a backlash. But I think the fact that corporations in particular feel so comfortable with this political movement is very interesting and very important, because what I think it reveals is that a lot of these woke youths, a lot of these woke campaign groups and protests, I see them very much as almost like the foot soldiers of neoliberalism, the militant wing of neoliberalism. Because what these movements do, they completely deflect attention away from the kind of things that the left was traditionally concerned about, which were questions of class, questions of employment, questions of jobs, questions of economic power, economic comfort. The woke mobs or the woke protesters seem increasingly uninterested in that area of life and are far more interested in pitting white people against black people, denouncing white men for being the cause of every ill on earth, treating black people as victims, and engaging in a form of identitarian division. And I think corporations instinctively warm to that because they recognize that it's a way of essentially divide and rule. And if working people or ordinary people or the majority of society, whatever we want to call them, if they are divided along these lines, if they are constantly told, you're a white person, you need to watch your language, you're a black person, therefore you're a victim and you need certain forms of assistance, whatever arguments are put forward, I think people in power recognize that if the majority of society are being divided in this way, then it's probably easier to control them. It's probably easier to put down any genuine threat to the economic interests of the elites. And I think they welcome what the woke protesters are doing because they recognize that in the long term, it will probably be beneficial to the establishment.
I'd like to continue a thread on what you said about Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, since I've given my own personal commentary and views about DiAngelo's book. And I ask my audience, if you're going to read and take seriously White Fragility, the book, and now it's being advocated for schools to do it, not just advocated, now the school unions, administrators, and the inclusive departments are now demanding that, and now parents are being told, read this book because this is the book of the future. I thought, what will that do if a parent, and especially the parents that we have today, the parents of this woke generation, where there's no manners, there's no morals, there's no ethic, there's no sense of history, there's an intellectual void, what will they do when they take to heart that they were born of some genetic original sin, and therefore, no matter how good they try to be, how open, how colorblind, it won't work because they must every day wake up feeling guilt and shame because they're the color of their skin. And then it also erases all of the major advances that we've made in race relations and giving opportunities to those who have been excluded historically, and no one is denying that. And then when you look at all the people who've succeeded, you know, you had a president of the United States, you had attorney general, you had another attorney general, you had a secretary of state, you've had the head of the UN from the American ambassador and national security advisor. You've had all these people who came from backgrounds, educated themselves, and you didn't hear any of them saying, I'm prevented from doing this because of the racism within all whites. Yes, there are whites that are racist. There are racists in almost every group. But it doesn't mean that you should moniker someone for the rest of their life. Think of the depression. Think of the suicidality. Think of the low self-esteem, which we already have an abundance of. So I said, before you read that alone, also read Mein Kampf. Because there's a book that was written by a functional idiot, Adolf Hitler, who also used the race card based upon a person's imperfect genes. You're not Aryan enough. And look at the consequences of that genocide that came from that against the Jews. Now you could say, well, this is not the early 1930s. And I'm going to say, in many ways, we are 1922 Italy under Mussolini. We're 1932 at the beginning of the Nazis in Germany before the Night of the Long Knives or Broken Glass. And all you have to do is have a very complicit society that is open to being, let's say, convinced of the rightness of someone, even when that should by any measure be discarded. And I feel that what we're about to see is an enormous push for conformity in ideology, teaching, how things are taught, curriculum, who can work at a job, what jobs you will be excluded for because you're not the right race. And therefore, I consider that a form of reverse racism. And I don't believe that the average person is fully aware of where this is going. Your thoughts?
It's very interesting that you mentioned how similar the current period feels to 1920s Italy, because I've often thought that myself. I'm always ever so slightly wary of comparisons with 1930s Germany, because, you know, the way in which those comparisons were wheeled out following the vote for President Donald Trump or following the vote for Brexit in the UK, I think it became an exhausted, cynically exploited metaphor or comparison, which ended up being very unuseful. But I have been thinking recently about the way in which these, you know, very often young groups of people, well-educated, middle class or upper middle class, talk about race all the time, who think about everything in racial terms, everything, and they can't watch a movie without wondering if the black character had enough lines. They can't look at a parliament or a political system without counting the number of black faces, counting the number of Asian faces. You know, they are myopically obsessed with race. And I've been thinking about how these, and they're often quite destructive. They tear down statues, they burn books, they want to ban speakers who have problematic views. And I'm struck by how similar this is to earlier historic moments. It does echo 1920s Italy. I think it does also echo Mao's China at the end of the 1960s, when there were also youthful, unforgiving, intolerant youthful movements who tore down statues, who tore up old books, who attacked older people who had the wrong views. So I think there are a lot of historical echoes that are very useful for understanding what I consider to be the crisis we're currently going through, the crisis of freedom, the crisis of reason. And I think, you know, something you've just touched on there is very important, which is that the most unforgivable thing that this new movement or this new ideology has done has been to rehabilitate racial thinking, to rehabilitate the racial worldview and the idea that there are white people, there are black people, there are brown people, they are completely different. They cannot possibly understand each other. We all need some form of therapeutic guidance from the race experts, people like Robin DiAngelo and others. And they now encourage us, in fact, they cajole us constantly into thinking in racial terms and into approaching everyday life, working life, educational life, social life. They want us to approach all of those things racially. And that is such a stab in the back to the great leaps forward that were made in America in the 1950s and 60s, and here in the United Kingdom in the 1970s and 80s, when there were civil rights movements or anti-racist movements, which really challenged the racialization of people and argued, in the words of Martin Luther King, to judge people by their character rather than their color. And Robin DiAngelo, I see someone like her as being similar to Richard Spencer. And what I mean by that, I don't mean she wants to live in an ethno state or anything like that, but both of those people, Richard Spencer and Robin DiAngelo, share the view that white people are a specific group of people. They must understand themselves as white. They must understand themselves as a racial group with particular privileges or particular advantages, and they must approach the world all the time as white people. And I think people, my great concern about people like Robin DiAngelo and others who talk constantly about white fragility and white privilege and the problem of white people, they're constantly saying to white people, you're a white person, you're a white person, you're a white person, that's all you are. Everything you think comes from this, the way you behave comes from this. And to my mind, it is not remotely surprising that some people will turn around and say, okay, I'm white. I'm going to organize along the lines of the white race. I'm going to stand up for myself as a member of the white race, and I'm going to push forward the politics of the white race. I think there's a very close relationship between those two things. And I think sections of the woke establishment are playing with fire, and they really need to recognize that sooner rather than later. And, you know, the United Kingdom is similar to the way in which you've just described the United States, in the sense that people from ethnic minority groups have done very well. Right now, the United Kingdom is pretty much run by non-white people. So we have our prime minister, who's obviously white, that's Boris Johnson, but the three highest offices of state are occupied by people from Asian backgrounds, by which I mean South Asian backgrounds. So the Home Office, the Home Secretary is Priti Patel, who's from Indian heritage. The Chancellor of the Exchequer is Rishi Sunak, who is from Pakistani Indian heritage. And the Attorney General is Suella Braverman, who is also from South Asian heritage. These are people who run the law, who run security, and who run the economy. The vast majority of people in Britain are absolutely fine with that, because we've been through a process where we've overcome the politics of race. We judge people by their individual skills and their character and their beliefs and what they want to do in the world. And in comes these woke people, these woke activists, and what they are doing is saying, no, you have to think in racial terms. You have to judge people by the color of their skin. And that is unforgivable, and even worse, it's dangerous.
Thank you. I appreciate, Brendan, those insights. Let us look at some of the hypocrisy that we also see, especially in the American media. On the one hand, if a person takes a knee or not, that's their business. I really don't care. I never question people about their religion, their body politic. I don't care. That's their right. It's not my right to determine if someone's legitimate based upon those views. I judge someone based upon what they do. Are they a good person? You know, are they moral? Are they ethical? Are they considerate? Are they empathetic? Those are the values I consider important, not a person's background, religion, etc. But that said, now we have the idea that LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick and all these other celebrities, Odell Beckham, all outstanding athletes, absolutely, but they're receiving tens to hundreds of millions of dollars, Tiger Woods, it's over $200 million, from Nike. And yet, Nike runs sweatshops. It is fully documented. It is not a specious or speculative comment. So how, on the one hand, can you say, you know, we care about not exploiting people because their ethnicity or race, And then you turn around and you're receiving tons of money. The whole baseball league, the basketball league, the football league, Nike is everything. And yet go into where those people actually make their running shoes or jerseys and look at the living conditions, because it's been done. I've seen it. I've talked about it. I've been talking about this in Nike and other people exploiting this slave. I talk about dresses made in Bangladesh where a woman earns 26 cents an hour and has to work 14-hour days and has the shortest work life expectancy in the world of 33 years. And yet that dress will go into a designer in London or Paris or New York City. No one cares where it came from. So how about all these people saying, we're opposed to any kind of exploitation? I would say, yes, I agree. Now, why don't you give back all the money that you gave to Nike? And why don't you start boycotting Nike and all these other clothing and other places? Your thoughts?
There is no one as hypocritical as the woke corporation. I mean, it is now becoming increasingly transparent just how hypocritical these corporations are. I mean, they will pay lip service to woke ideas. They will turn their social media pages black for Black Lives Matter. They will issue statements about the importance of Black lives and the importance of respecting minorities and so on, while at the same time, as you described very well, exploiting people both in the United States, where often people are underpaid and work in, you know, less than desirable conditions, but even more graphically in the South, in the global South, or the third world, as we used to call it, where many of these corporations employ people in terrible conditions and exploit their labor to an extraordinary degree. And they are just stinking hypocrites, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there was a very good example of it in the UK a few years ago, when lots of very posh, wealthy, well-connected feminists all started wearing this fancy t-shirt which said, this is what a feminist looks like. And it became a very fashionable thing to wear this t-shirt so you could declare to the world that you are a feminist. It later transpired that these t-shirts were being made by horribly exploited, underpaid women in India. And I thought that was just a very good example of how there's almost like a slave-like relationship between the ability of often wealthy Westerners, particularly corporates or the people who do adverts for corporates, the ability of them to walk around preening in public and virtue signaling and telling everyone how wonderfully aware they are. But a lot of that is built on the hard work, the underpaid work, the exploited work of the faceless millions in other parts of the world who keep this stuff going and who produce these products, often because they have little choice, they need a job. So I think that's one of the most awful things. And that's one of the things that often surprises me about the way, the fact that these new movements are referred to as left. Now, I don't want to get hung up on the language or become too pedantic about this, but traditionally the left was interested in liberating people from the harsher forms of exploitation and ensuring that everyone had safe working conditions and good pay. And what we've had over the past few years is a shift of the left away from those incredibly important concerns towards something which is much more performative, which is much more about saying something about yourself as an individual. I'm a saved person. I'm a good person. I'm a pure person because I wear a Black Lives Matter t-shirt. I say the right things on my social media page. I use the right language in relation to gender fluidity and pronouns and so on. It's all, you know, going back to the kind of cult-like, religious-like idea, it's all about demonstrating something about the self. You are a saved person, whereas everyone else is, you know, wrong or evil or immoral and worthy of nothing more than condemnation. And I think when supposedly or ostensibly left-wing politics becomes this kind of performative display of your own personal salvation, you completely lose sight of what was incredibly important to politics in the past, which was a sense of collectivity, solidarity, aspiring to create a world in which everyone had equal opportunity, equal rights, and the right to a good job and the right to good pay. And slowly but surely, we now have supposedly radical movements in the US and the UK in particular, who never think about the people who are toiling to make their T-shirts or to make their V for Vendetta masks that they wear on their protests, or who are working to make Nike trainers. They don't think about those people. They just think about the glossy, wonderful Nike advert on Fifth Avenue in New York City or in Piccadilly Circus in London. And they take a picture of it and they put it on Instagram and they say, I agree with Nike, Black Lives Matter. And what I would say to those people is you need to shake your head a lot and realize that there are far more profound problems in the world. And corporations like Nike are responsible for some of those problems.
Thank you. I want to follow up on that because Richard Gale, who you've been speaking with, and I have written over, I think it's now 12 articles on 5G and its danger to the environment and people, all with scientific citations. We've written over 47 articles on the lack of real safety and efficacy in vaccines, and again, all only using peer-reviewed literature. And at the same time, the mainstream media refuses to acknowledge any legitimacy in anything that challenges any of its government positions or major corporate positions. So then we took a look at the major industries, banking, which is the finance industry, food like Monsanto and DuPont, and big energy cartels like Shell, etc., and also the educational systems. And we found every single major industry was top-heavy in neoliberalist ideologies, meaning they were after every buck they could make and as much power as they could gain, and the media was not challenging them at all. So I'll give you one example. Coronavirus 19. I've done maybe 30 broadcasts on it. Now, being a scientist, being a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, a senior research fellow at the Institute of Biology for over 33 years, publishing peer-reviewed literature, doing over 44 clinical studies, I have to hold myself to account that anything I'm going to share with the audience has to be based in some sensibilities of good science, common sense, and benefit. So when I'm reading the literature on the COVID, the very first thing I ask is, how do we know that all these people who are being told are positive were actually positive? What test did they use? Then we find out that the test was the PCR test. And I happen to know Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering that test. And he said emphatically, I filmed him saying it, never use my test to determine viral load. It doesn't measure viral load, nor anything other than the amplification of a single virus. Now, I'll show you where this is going. So therefore, you could have had a cold 20 years ago, get a PCR antibody test and show positive. There is, as of today, there's not a single antibody test that can distinguish any of the other 18 COVIDs from the current one. So if your entire social programming, if your whole idea that people must stay quarantined, destroying millions of businesses, adversely affecting people's lives, keeping people who could have the virus, a younger person, in a home where there's an older person with comorbidities, which is really what people die from more often than not, that is a terrible policy. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, allowed thousands of people to die in nursing homes because he refused to put the people with nursing home into a critical care center. He let them go back into the nursing home, and hence all this. Now he washes his hands like Pontius Pilate. So everything that I've seen, the science has been terrible. The declaration from Anthony Fauci are wrong. The rush to a vaccine that is new, an experimental vaccine where there's no legitimate animal studies as well as human trials. And even the initial studies we've seen shows it's highly, highly problematic. It'll work and have side effects. And yet anything that comes from the average medical doctor, hey, we're using hydroxychloroquine with zinc and an antibiotic, and 100% of our patients, this is about 10 different doctors, 350 patients cured, another group cured, if you get it within the first few days, first 7 days, and if it's 200 milligrams. Now that is being blocked, and then the media is attacking every single scientist, the top epidemiologist in the United States, the number one, an MD, PhD, head of epidemiology at Yale, published over 300 articles. He says that hydroxychloroquine with zinc and the antibiotic and all of the studies he has reviewed, and it's over 1,500 people, it's worked. Now there's a study with 130,000 people, and it works. You won't see a word about it anywhere in the media. The government won't announce any of it. It's everything about the vaccine. Well, there's your big people, including Bill Gates. And anyone even advocating for another approach is a quack or a charlatan. And I see what is going on right now in the body politic, both with Democrats and Republicans, as being emblematic of supporting the status quo of those in charge who profit most and not looking at the truth of how we shouldn't have quarantined people. Yes, the virus is real. Yes, it can kill people, but not in the way that we were told. And if we would have protected the people who had comorbidities by giving them good care, then those people, many of them would have been alive today. And instead of wrecking the whole world's economy with this nonsense, the way we're approaching it now, it's been politicized and weaponized. That's my feeling on it. I've written about it. Your thoughts, please.
You know, we've had a very similar situation in the UK to the one that you've just described in New York in particular, which is the catastrophic error we made in the UK is that we locked down healthy people and we failed to lock down people with comorbidities or people in care homes, elderly people. And so what we did, we successfully locked every single person in their homes. We put them under house arrest. We locked down the whole of society. So we're talking about people in their 30s and their 40s and their 50s, people who are incredibly unlikely to get very ill from COVID-19. They were prevented from going to work. They were prevented from building, producing, doing the things that a society needs in order to survive. So we locked away the healthy and the fit who work and who keep the economy alive. We failed to protect elderly people and people with comorbidities. So in the UK, we did the exact same thing that Cuomo and others have done, which is that we sent sick elderly people back into care homes. We didn't ring fence care homes, even though we knew at a certain stage of the progression of COVID, we knew that it was far more lethal for older people and people with comorbidities than it is for people under the age of 70 and especially under the age of 60. So we did everything wrong. And I think other countries did likewise. And I think that's all, or rather, that is primarily down to politics, because we responded in a hysterical way to a virus that it turned out was not as lethal as people originally said. I say this as someone who's had COVID. I had it in March. I was actually quite ill for 2 weeks. I've now subsequently donated my plasma to the National Health Service because they need plasma from people who've had COVID or who've had the symptoms of COVID, because it's beneficial in terms of treating other people. And what I've realized is it's a nasty bug in people who are not old and who don't have comorbidities, but it is absolutely not a reason to shut down the world economy and to plunge Britain. We are currently in the worst recession on record. A recession far worse than the 2008 crash, far worse than the Great Depression, although hopefully it won't last as long as that did, and which is actually the worst recession we've had in this country since the Great Frost of the early 1700s, when the world went through the coldest spell of the millennia, and as a consequence, production in the United Kingdom virtually collapsed and people suffered enormously as a consequence. We are now in a recession that is akin to that. And as a consequence, millions of people will lose their jobs. The economy is in downturn. And if you don't have a healthy economy, you can't invest in health. You can't invest in social services. You can't invest in house building. People get depressed. People become alcoholics. People commit suicide. And I think the long-term health consequences of our irrational response to COVID could well prove to be worse than the health consequences of COVID itself. But it's really important that we talk about why this happened. It didn't, you know, our governments didn't suddenly go mad. They didn't overnight just lose their minds. This kind of political climate has been building for a long time. It's down to the politics of fear, the politics of irrationalism, this apocalyptic worldview, which says that every bad thing that happens is a sign of the end of the world. You know, we've been in the grip of a kind of apocalyptism, a fashionable apocalyptism, for quite a long time, which means that governments and others in positions of influence are increasingly likely to believe the worst case scenarios. And as soon as they are presented with the worst case scenarios, they will say, right, let's shut down society. It doesn't matter about the consequences, doesn't matter about jobs, doesn't matter about freedom, shut everything down. So this has been growing for a long time, and the COVID period of from March through to the current time has really just brought all of that together. And that's why you talk there about freedom, particularly the freedom to speak and the freedom to criticize. Those things become more important in a moment of crisis even than they are in a normal moment. It's precisely when society is faced by a threat, whether it's a very large threat or, as COVID seems to be turning out, a small to medium threat. It's precisely when society is faced by a threat that freedom and the freedom to speak and the freedom to ask questions becomes more important. We should never let our governments close down society and the economy without raising our hands and asking difficult questions. So the thing that we've been talking about, this kind of clampdown, this broader clampdown on freedom and dissent and questioning that takes place in many spheres of life today, that's part of the reason we're in this predicament we're currently in. Because if you crush freedom, you will silence the voices who will say, is the lockdown the right thing to do? What about the loss of jobs? What about the declining health of people who are unemployed? Is COVID really as great a threat to human health as we were initially told? If you silence those kinds of questions, you will make it completely predictable that society will go down a particular path and no one will be allowed to criticize it.
In fact, to add on to what you just suggested, I have been advocating, at least to my radio audience, to be as healthy as possible, because a healthy immune system is what prevents almost the vast majority of illnesses, from diabetes to heart disease to these very comorbidities. And yet the government is not, outside of sanitation, which I believe in, the government's not telling people that vitamin D and vitamin C and a healthy diet and exercise and stress management also build your immune system. It's as if they want everything to be a pharmacological approach. And a part of the current woke generation wants the government to do all their thinking, to answer all their questions, and to be the enforcer of their ideology. Now, I'll tell you one example of this. About 2 years ago, I was watching a television program, and a woman was on there talking about why it was completely wrong to change a baby's diaper without getting the baby's permission. And I thought, what? Is that a parody? No. And then from there it went to, if you're with your partner, you cannot hold their hands unless you ask permission. If you're sleeping, you cannot cuddle with them unless you ask their permission. Otherwise, it's a form of assault. So they go from go from absurdities like asking your baby's permission to change its diaper, otherwise it's assault upon the sanctity of the baby's body, to having to ask your partner's permission before you share any intimacy at all. And otherwise, it's an assault of this whole microaggression phenomena. And I thought, this can't possibly take hold, but it has taken hold. And now university students are saying, in some universities, and not all its students, I don't care your background as a professor or what you're here to teach. I'm here because I want to feel safe and protected and comfortable. No critical thought, no critical questions. And if you think that's a joke, I can introduce you to some people who no longer are tenured professors because they lost their jobs because of this Title IX, where anonymous people criticized them, and then they had to change. Your thoughts?
I think you've actually touched on something really important there, which is the question of why so many young people, particularly people who would consider themselves right on or social justice activists, why they have been so in favor of the lockdown. I mean, in the United Kingdom, which I can speak to more accurately, those kinds of people have been lockdown fanatics. They have loved the lockdown. They have absolutely raged against anyone who has dared to protest against the lockdown, or anyone who has raised questions about mandatory mask wearing, or anyone who has called into question the wisdom of shutting down economic and social life in the UK, which is a powerhouse of the global economy, for 4 or 5 months. They will rage against anyone who does that. And I think the reason that section of society in particular is so in favour of the lockdown is precisely what you said, which is that these are the kinds of people for whom politics is increasingly about keeping people safe. It's increasingly about the safe space, which is what they call it in campuses, and this notion that the only responsibility that the state and other forms of authority have is to protect us from harm, to ensure that we are never offended, that we never see or hear something we disagree with or find difficult, that we are never chatted up in a campus bar without our permission, that everything has to be, you know, written consent has to be provided for every human interaction before it takes place. If you bring up a generation thinking like that, thinking that words wound, ideas are dangerous, other people are toxic, and if they ask to buy you a drink, that's part of rape culture. If you bring people up in that kind of climate, it's not surprising that they respond to a problem like COVID by saying, shut down the whole of society, keep me safe, let me stay at home, protect me at all costs. You know, we've created this risk-averse generation who seriously think that they can glide through life without ever encountering something disagreeable, or without ever falling ill, or without ever having an experience that is not a necessarily desirable experience. You know, we've created this mollycoddled generation, and it's not just young people, it spreads into people in their 30s and their 40s, and some people who are older than that, who think that they can go through life without encountering any form of harm. And I think that's a really dangerous way to approach life, because it's unrealistic. And it means that you become pro-authoritarian, because you will accept any kind of authoritarian measure so long as it protects you and keeps you in your safe space, keeps you wrapped up in cotton wool. And the campus, I think campuses have a lot to answer for here. You know, I've been the victim of campus censorship. I was prevented from giving a speech at Oxford University a few years ago. It was a debate about abortion, and there were two male journalists. I was going to give the pro-choice side, and the other male journalist was going to give the pro-life side. And the Feminist Society at Oxford University decided that it was unacceptable for two men to talk about abortion, so they threatened to disrupt the event and make sure that it couldn't take place. And Oxford University caved in and agreed to call the event off, and they banned it. And that became a bit of an explosive talking point in the campus wars, because people were saying, well, if you can't have a free debate at Oxford University, the oldest and in some ways the most prestigious university in the world, then where can you have a free debate? And the argument that was pushed forward by the people who prevented that debate from going forward, they all said it would make them feel unsafe. They all said that our arguments would make them feel unsafe. The presence of two men who have opinions on the issue of abortion would make them feel unsafe, and therefore it shouldn't go ahead. And I think mainstream society doesn't recognize how foolish and dangerous it is to allow a certain generation to believe that they should always feel intellectually safe. They should never feel intellectually challenged, because it's only through having confrontation and discussion and debate and ridicule and all these other things, which are often very uncomfortable, it's only by having those things that you can keep your mind working, you can keep your ideas fresh, and you give yourself the right to change your mind. That's such an important right in a free society, the right to change your mind. Whereas if you hide away in the safe space, or if you hide away in your locked down home during a pandemic, all you're doing is turning yourself into a child and begging for protection. And that's always a mistake.
About 3 months ago, I did a whole commentary for an hour on just asking, what are we not focused upon? Because of all of our energy is either on identity politics or on COVID. Well, why haven't anyone any of the people in Congress on either side, Republican or Democrat, and in none of the presidents, going clear back to Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. and before then George Bush Jr. or after George Bush Jr. and Obama, why haven't they done anything to take all the money out of politics so the average person could have a chance to run for office? Why haven't they reversed the Glass-Steagall? They haven't. Or why haven't they put a moratorium on all of the interventions in other countries' democratically elected processes because it doesn't meet our hegemonic principles? Why haven't we voted in universal health care? If you took the profit out of universal health care from the pharmaceutical companies and the hospitals, you would save $2 trillion a year. Yet even the so-called enlightened woke Democrats want to have universal health care but keep the profit in. That shows you the lack of depth in their understanding. Why haven't we reapportioned 80% of the military-industrial complex budget, which is 58% of all money spent of our tax dollars goes to them, and they don't need it, to rebuilding society, rebringing manufacturing back? Why haven't we done the things like helping farmers and forgiving student loans they have a chance to start without debt pennies? Why haven't we closed the for-profit prisons? In 1826, around that area, we outlawed debtors' prisons. We have debtors' prisons today. Why don't we outlaw that? Why don't we outlaw any interest on a credit card or payday loan more than 2% what banks and other people make? But not a single one of 50 points did we do. Not a single, nothing in our justice code was changed and our stupid war on drugs was changed. So the people saying they're awoke and guiding us and the people believing that we have the best and brightest in office, they're not looking at the fact they've done nothing to help save the planet, reduce pollution, nothing to help increase our health, nothing to help us live a longer, more fruitful life. Your thoughts?
See, I think that cuts to the heart of the problem that we currently face, which is when politics becomes almost exclusively about identity and almost exclusively about a performative description of yourself and your own decency and your own goodness, when it becomes about virtue signaling, when it becomes about thinking myopically about people's race or their gender or whatever else it might be, that's divisive and destructive in and of itself. But the broader problem is that it explicitly detracts political attention away from the bigger unresolved questions of history. And the largest unresolved question of history is, how do we ensure that ordinary people have clout? How do we ensure that they have an impact on political life? And how do we ensure that their interests are pursued? So in other words, how do we dismantle the influence of incredibly wealthy people or incredibly well-connected elites, or, you know, the establishment, as we used to call them? How do we dismantle the influence of that section of society and ensure that working people and ordinary people have a voice, and a voice that counts for an enormous amount? And the woke nonsense that we're currently experiencing explicitly detracts attention from that. I think it actually does it on purpose. Or if it doesn't do it on purpose, then it certainly does it as an incredibly important byproduct of its political outlook. And that's, as I say, that's why corporations love it. That's why Kamala Harris loves it. That's why sections of the Labour Party in the United Kingdom love it. They love this stuff because it is not a threat to the establishment. And on the contrary, it often furthers the interests of the establishment by keeping working people divided and by ensuring that we're all navel-gazing and talking about our racial experiences or talking about the harm we feel, rather than collectively organizing to make the world a better place. So that's a very serious problem we face, and I think it's one that progressives and others ought to be taking incredibly seriously. But I really agree with you about the question of how we ensure that normal people, unwealthy people, how do we ensure that they have a real impact on political life? And when I think about the UK, you know, the great progressive steps forward in England in particular, but also the UK more broadly, they've all been about the question of how do we lessen the influence of the rich and powerful and increase the influence of the poor and the unpowerful? That has been the question that has driven progressives and radicals in the UK and other parts of the world for centuries. You know, there was a movement in England in the 1840s, the Chartist movement, which was a movement for the right of working class men to have the vote. And then, of course, it was followed by the suffragette movement in the 1910s, which was for the right of women to have the vote. And the Chartist movement for the right of working class men to vote, they always made the point that it was essential that if you live under the laws of a society, then you have to have an absolute equal say in how that society is run. And they put forward loads of progressive arguments. They said members of parliament should have a wage, because then at that time, members of parliament didn't have a wage, which meant only incredibly wealthy people could sit in parliament and poor people couldn't. They argued that we have to start to tap into the common sense of working people, the concerns of working people, the fact that working people often have a keener understanding of the problems facing society than aristocrats and priests and bureaucrats do. And I think lots of those arguments, quite sadly, have been lost in recent decades. They've been pushed aside. And those kind of very positive, in my view, very democratic arguments, which were about how to bring in as many voices as possible into the political sphere in order to ensure that all sorts of interests were represented rather than simply the interests of the powerful and the wealthy. We really do have to have that discussion again, have that discussion fresh, and ensure that political life doesn't become dominated either by neoliberals or woke activists, but rather becomes a forum in which ordinary people can make demands, put pressure on the elites, and insist on the creation of a fairer, freer society.
Brendan O'Neill, thank you very much for your insights. We're out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time from Great Britain to share your thoughts with us.
Thanks very much, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.